Hi, yes, I'm Cindy. I'm really glad to be here. It's nice to see a room full of my people. And I want to start by a personal invitation to every single one of you to please plan to come to the Al-Anon International, which will be in Baltimore, Maryland in 2018. Put that in your planning. We'd love to see you there. Anyway, it's a privilege to be here and to try to get us started on this topic. I also love this book, so I'm going to start by just reading a couple of lines from the introduction that really touch me. So it'll just get me grounded, I think. Living with the disease of alcoholism affects us physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Being able to recognize and name our losses is a vital first step towards facing our grief. Before recovery, I used to think grief only happened when someone died. As I got more and more honest, I saw that I had been in grief much of my life but had no name for it. I finally understood what was happening to me. So I just find those words really powerful, and I'll start by saying that I'm the granddaughter of an alcoholic, the daughter of an alcoholic, the mother of an alcoholic, and you would think, having said that, I would have gotten here when I was 15, but it took me a long darn time. My first marriage, I think, was to another adult child. We had three children, and we divorced after 24 years of marriage because all I did was blame him for my unhappiness. And about 14 years into my single life and finding myself involved in increasingly dysfunctional relationships, I went to see a professional. The first thing that professional said to me was, "I think Al-Anon would really be good for you." And I heard her, and then she handed me a book. It was not conference approved, but it was about adult children of alcoholics. And I can remember so vividly reading the introduction of this book, and somewhere in the introduction were words something like this. Congratulations. If you're reading this book, you survived. And it sent me into sobbing, crying. I mean, the floodgates opened when I read those lines. And I think it was the first time I had any idea that growing up in a family affected by this disease had any impact on me. I was in such denial. I had no idea. So where do I go from there? I really felt somewhat overwhelmed when I had the topic, opening our hearts, transforming our losses, because I feel like the losses are, I mean, there's a huge list of them. So what do I focus on today? So I decided what I needed to focus on was one of my losses that has involved a relationship with my oldest child. And we have struggled in a variety of ways, but in the last several years of my recovery, I feel like some miracles have happened. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what I've learned about myself and about this now almost 50-year-old man, who I still think of as my little boy, right, sometimes. So I will say that when he was born, I was proud and excited. And then very soon, it was clear that I had a plan for him. I had a plan. He was going to be the best person ever. He was going to excel at everything. He was going to be socially charming. He was going to be academically gifted. He was going to be an athlete. He was going to be all of those things. And somewhere along the way, I think it was high school, there was a kink in my plan because he began exhibiting behaviors that were absolutely not what I had in mind. And it seemed that drug use became an issue for him. And, you know, things started disappearing in our house. There were lots of lies and difficult communication between he and myself and his father and himself. And there were, his grades took a nosedive. I mean, it just felt like it was disaster everywhere. He had been on the basketball team, and he got kicked off the basketball team. So I was like, I was in panic. I was in panic mode. This is long before I found the rooms of Al-Anon. So I shifted in a little higher gear. And it was all, I mean, the only thing I was focused on was how to fix this kid, how to get him in the right path. And so I'd spend hours lecturing him about teaching him how he should be, you know? I was sure that if I could just say that the right way, he'd understand and he'd stop doing what he was doing and start applying himself and be the guy I wanted him to be. That was not what happened. He went to college and flunked out his first semester. And his father and I said, well, we're sorry, but we're done. You're going to have to figure out another way to make your way in this world. So we joined the Army. And while he was in the Army, at some point, we didn't find this out until quite a few years later, he was caught smuggling drugs across the border between Germany and Belgium. And the Army asked him to leave. And he didn't tell us that. So we thought he had this Army college fund that he could draw on if he was going to go to school. And he never told us he wasn't eligible anymore. So anyway, there was a lot of back and forth. And really, I think that my struggle with trying to make this young man into something that he wasn't, and his father's approach, which was kick him out, you know, get him out of here. He's got to figure it out on himself. I mean, now I know he was much healthier than I was. But anyway, it ruined our marriage. So we divorced, and I found the rooms of Al-Anon, let's see, I think it was in 1995. So this is my 20-year anniversary. And, yep. I still have a lot to learn. But anyway, I want to tell about, you know, what happened later. This son of mine, who never went back to college, really tried very hard and always had big ideas about how successful he was going to be. I wonder where he got that idea from. Created his own business, and it seemed to be doing really well. And there was a moment in time when things, I guess, were shaky. And the next thing we knew, the business had been shut down. And I think he had to declare bankruptcy. I don't know that for sure, but I think so. And that began a period of time when he closed the door on his mother and his father and his brother and his sister and didn't want any communication with any of us. Well, so for me, that became an incredible challenge. You know, I was still, I mean, even at that age, and even though I was in Al-Anon, I still wanted the best for him and had him in my thoughts a lot. And frankly, I was probably way too focused on this oldest child. I mean, that's just craziness, and to the detriment of his brother and sister. So anyway, my sponsor says, Cindy, this is an incredible opportunity for you as well. So she suggested that I do a four-step on my relationship with this son. So she said, start writing about what it was like when you found out you were pregnant, and just write about what it was like with the two of you and, you know, your dynamic from the time he was born till now. Well, I wrote a while. And when I finally was able to share that with my sponsor, some things became clear. I really didn't know until then how much my need to control him was really a rejection of who he was. I could not validate his choices. I could only reject them. I was really good at the yes buts. You know, he'd say one thing and I'd say yes but, like I know better. And I was so ashamed of myself. You know, I look back on my upbringing. You know, I was the oldest of two girls. I really think my mother, who was an adult child as well as an alcoholic, raised me in much the same way I raised my son. She wanted me to look good, like I wanted him to look good, because it would make me feel better about myself. And my parents, who had both been, they met when they were both teaching high school. Academics were really important to them. So when I dropped out of college my sophomore year, they were not happy. So, I mean, it's what a nice repeating pattern, eh? I don't know what it was like in your family, but that's what it was like in mine. You know, the oldest child seemed to get the focus for succeeding, doing well, making the family look good. So it happened to me, and I passed it on to this son of mine. I want to just check my notes for a couple of things here. Well, some of the gifts that that fourth and fifth step gave me were enormous. One was it gave me some distance from this young man. You know, I really think today we were enmeshed. We were much too involved with each other. And he needed a break from me, and I needed a break from him. And frankly, I needed to have a relationship with my other son, who was an alcoholic, and his sister, my daughter. You know, they're all wonderful people. They each have their own challenges. But I had put all this energy into the oldest child. The other thing that was amazing was the was the opportunity to work my sixth and seventh step. You know, my sponsor, I said, so now that I've done all this, now what? She said, well, you know, you have a lot to deal with. She says, you've got to, first of all, accept your son exactly as he is, not the way you fantasized him to be or the way you wanted him to be. You've got to forgive yourself. That was a tall order. I felt such shame and such guilt and such sorrow that I had contributed to his difficulties tremendously by my attitudes. And then we started talking about, well, how was I going to live with his refusal to communicate with me? And she said, well, Cindy, you can send him a birthday card and you can send him a Christmas card, but you're not going to call him and you're not going to guilt trip him. You're not going to say, oh, I miss you so terribly. Please call. Please come for Christmas dinner. Please come for Thanksgiving dinner. You're not going to do that because you're going to give this young man the dignity to decide if and when he wants to be in touch with his family, whether it's you or anybody else. So, okay, I will tell you that that challenge continued for 4.5 years. If you had told me when this child was born that I would have 4.5 years where I couldn't speak with him and he wouldn't speak to me, I would have said, you're crazy. But that's exactly what it took, and I think my higher power knew it would take it that 4.5 years. So, last year, Mother's Day 2014, my husband and I were out of town. When we got back into town, we were listening to the answering machine on our telephone, and here's a message from this son. He says, Mom, I'm on your front porch. I came here to wish you a happy Mother's Day. And it looks like your house has been sold. And he was right. We were getting ready to move, only, of course, he hadn't been in contact for a while, so he didn't know that. So I was both thrilled and terrified, frankly, by this message. And I think it was the next day that he left a phone number. He said, please call me when you can. I called him. We talked for about an hour. He said, well, I'd like to take you out to lunch. So we went out to lunch a few days later, and he was sort of trying to catch me up on what he was doing with his life. And I really worked hard, and I am still working hard and learning to keep my mouth shut, not ask questions, not say, well, so what happened when you lost your business? I haven't said anything about that. And he hasn't either. How about that? So we're in the process of trying to build a relationship again, and it's really from my perspective, and because of a loving higher power and a loving sponsor in my life, it is a whole new ball game, and I feel like it's the kind of relationship that I wish I could have had 50 years ago with him. But you get it when you get it, right? The thing that's just so astounding to me is that the challenge of having him out of my life for 4.5 years became an incredible gift. I mean, who would have thought that? I mean, I'd heard in the rooms a lot of times about people who, you know, we have to separate ourselves from our family sometimes. I mean, it's normal in this disease to like back off and stay away because it's just not working. But it can be very healing. So it's been incredibly helpful for me. I'm trying to think of what I want to do next. I have another couple of readings from this beautiful book that are very meaningful to me, particularly now. Guilt over past mistakes can keep us trapped. It helps to have compassion for ourselves and our children. Even if we made mistakes in the past, we didn't cause anyone to become an alcoholic, including our adult children. We simply don't have that kind of power. We can remember to forgive ourselves. We can accept that we did the best we could at the time with the resources we had. Today, we can make a commitment to do things differently. And another paragraph. Our children's lives may not have turned out the way we had hoped, but we can't prevent them from learning the lessons they are meant to learn today. Whatever problems they may be facing are theirs to face. They have their own path, their own journey. Though it may be unclear to us now, perhaps our children are meant to go through exactly what they are going through for a reason. I will also say I have 3 grandsons, and I'm pretty clear that this is an inherited disease. And I do look at these 3 young boys. One's 15, one's 12, almost 13. The other one's 12, almost 13 as well. And wondering if and or when this disease will crop up. But, you know, what Al-Anon has taught me is the need to love them and be compassionate and caring. And I just can't say enough for the gifts that this program has given me. You know, the losses have been many, you know, when I think of my mom and how I didn't understand her disease and how abandoned I felt and how angry I felt. And it took me about 10 years in Al-Anon to forgive her and understand her and embrace her again. You know, I adored so much about her, but not the disease part. Anyway, so I appreciate you helping me learn how to transform my losses. I appreciate you all for being my teacher, and I'm grateful to a loving higher power in my life today. Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. I could relate to what she was saying because I had been estranged from my daughter for about 10 years. And when she said she didn't validate his choices, I had to think about that really strongly and know that I didn't do that with Janie either. Okay, our next speaker is Angie, and she's from Wisconsin.
Good morning. My name is Angie Rose Miller, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. And I'm surprised there are so many people here at Opening Our Hearts, Transforming Our Losses. This would have been the last one I would have gone to. So the committee is like, hey, would you be willing to volunteer? I'm like, sure. As long as it's not, and I should have wrote this, as long as I don't have to talk about opening my heart, transforming my loss, or grief. So I'm one of these Al-Anons that I buy all the literature to support the cause, but I don't read any of it. You know, like I have, so I'm not the only one. So I have, you know, I have my standbys, my ODAT, love that one. The Hope for Today has become a new fave. So I had the book and, you know, it got published in like 2007. So I thought, well, I'm going to have to start cramming for it. So so I've only gotten about halfway through the book, but I brought it with me. So currently I am grieving the loss of sleep and an appetite. I unintentionally went on the peach and mixed nut body cleanse yesterday. So I'm a little like, I am really tired and really strung out, so I'm not nervous. But, so here's some of the chapter headings, right? And this is when I, like, congratulations, you're going to be here July 4th, woo! I'm like, great! Then I open the book, Grief is a Process, Living with the Family Disease of Alcoholism, Loss of the Dream, Grieving for Our Childhood, Loss in Relationships, Death of a Loved One. You know, this is, I mean, seriously, this is the stuff I've, like, run from. And I'm only on chapter 6. Okay, so dealing with our feelings. Okay, so before recovery, I was good with numb and happy. But there was no way. I mean, I managed and controlled my feelings so that I wouldn't feel. I was really rageful, though, when I was a kid, so I seemed to be okay with that one. But as I got older, and I could tell that that was, like, kind of inappropriate, that I just went to numb or happy. But I mean, stuff feelings. And that comes out sideways. I mean, I think I'm I'm not even consciously avoiding it. I just don't know how to. I don't know how to experience grief as a process. And don't talk to me about embracing it. There was a sentence in this book that said something about a lot of times we're afraid to deal with grief because we think we're going to be engulfed by it. And that was hands down my fear. I am going to get swallowed alive by all these feelings and I will never come out again. And I didn't know how to articulate that to people. I knew that sounded completely nuts. So I just didn't tell people. Taking care of ourselves. You know, now I feel like, okay, I can take care of myself. I'm not into the love myself. But I can, you know, sleep. Okay, so spiritual growth from grieving. I'm not one of those touchy-feely Al-Anons. You know, I really enjoy being here at the AA International. It's the third one I've been to. I got into Al-Anon December 30th of 1993. And I think about that now, and I was like, wow, I was 29 years old. You know, I, like, flamed out quick. Like, woof! You know, trashed by 29. But there's, you know, this loss, and oddly, of course, I get here and I want to get the lay of the land at the Marquee, which we're staying at the Doubletree, which I thought was nice, and then I got to this one and I'm like, of course, this is the Al-Anon Hotel. It's like, like, yeah, that's us. And so I'm roaming around the hotel and getting the lay of the land, and God, I don't even know where that was going. So other than I'm grateful to be with my people. Like, I really love all the rowdiness of alcoholics, and I've really enjoyed coming to the conference. I mean, sitting in a meeting last night with 56,000 other people and saying the Serenity Prayer together And saying the closing prayer together is just like, it gets me right in the chest. That is just amazing. But after a while, it's like, I have got to find my people. You know, where are the green stripy people? And I got this ribbon at San Antonio. I don't know why. I didn't have like a service position or anything, but I think this is so great and so obnoxious. And I keep wanting there to be like, I want to feel like Moses in the parting of the seas and the alcoholics just step aside. The Al-Anon is coming through. So, that hasn't happened yet, but. So it's been, but it's really, you know, it's astounding to me what's been given to us as Al-Anon family members from those, you know, two drunks sitting in a kitchen. And that it's just astounding to me in 80 years. The loss that I've, oh, I know why. Okay, so I'm roaming around the hotel, go to find the hospitality thing, right? So there's the things of, oh, here, come get a postcard. I open it up and it's something like, oh, you know, your grief or loss will turn into healing. I'm like, all right. Enough with the grief and loss, but this year my stepdad passed away. I just went to his funeral in June, and so, anyways, so God, this is so hard for me to talk about. And I was kind of hoping it was one of those meetings where everybody could get up and talk for 10 minutes, and we could just get the snot flying, and everybody could cry, and we could all feel cleansed. And I sometimes feel like I'm sort of emotionally constipated with all this stuff. But so my stepdad died. And the thing that was really interesting about that experience, and my mom is an untreated Al-Anon member, and I mean, there is the, I am just beginning to grasp how that has affected me. And not in a victim way. It's like my husband gets frustrated in traffic. My stomach is in a knot. And I am powerless over being that in tune with other people. And I sponsor 7 women, which I'm thinking, who thought of that? I mean, I have trouble with relationships. And so, and now I'm, you know, someone needs help and, you know, and I'm going to help you. I mean, that's like, that's, isn't that sort of like crack? I mean, it's kind of, I'll save you. No, I won't. Yes, I will. No, I won't. So I find navigating these relationships to be really hard. But what was so, and I expected to have a difficult time with my mom. My parents are in Michigan and I'm in Wisconsin, and that's for a reason. And for a long time, I thought I was just a chicken, that I was a coward and I wasn't facing the situation there. It was like flat out survival. And there's no doubt in my mind that God had a hand in getting me away from that. And so I knew I was going to have a difficult time with my mom. I did not expect to have a really difficult time with my dad. And what I understood about my stepdad passing, and he was an incredibly gentle, kind-hearted man, is he was the reason I went to go, that it even became tolerable for me to visit my parents. Because I'm the oldest, and I am the subject of criticism constantly. My one parent wants me to perform well, and the other one wants me to look good. And they have never let up on that. So when I kind of understood that, and what my mom did is she intervened in that relationship with my stepdad constantly. If I spent too much time with him, she got jealous. And she would come to visit us in Wisconsin, and she wouldn't bring him along because she had more fun without him. And it was, you know, and it's really, I don't know, I don't have any power over that, but I don't know what to say to that. I don't know how to respond to that. I don't know what to do with that stuff. So I make jokes, you know, I make jokes and laugh and ha-ha and do that kind of stuff. I did not expect to have a difficult time with my dad. And to the point that I have physically hit a wall that I've never hit in that relationship with that man, I cannot talk to this guy. And it was the morning that we were going to go to the funeral of my stepdad, and my dad decided to get into a debate, and he's always right, and it was one certain way, and that was it, and we got into a fight, and he said, we won't talk about this ever again. Deal? Deal. And I thought, you haven't even given me a chance to answer the question. But that's been my experience with my dad. He wants an audience. He has no interest, apparently, in my ideas or my experiences. And so that's a very difficult one. But it's really interesting. When I was really new in Al-Anon, one of my, like an Al-Anon friend, she said, you know, it's okay to be yourself even if he walks away, meaning my father. And I thought, no, it's not. No, it's not. But I don't tell people that. Now, this week in our recovery community, a guy, a member of Al-Anon, took his own life on Monday. And he was buried yesterday. And that just, I cannot stop thinking about this guy. And honest to God, I thought that family had everything. She was in recovery. He was in recovery. They had three gorgeous kids in a big house, and they had worked hard and earned all of that. And, you know, I saw them all around. And so this is serious, what we're doing here. And if we don't learn to open our hearts and be a little vulnerable, we're going to hide it. Hide it, hide it, hide it, hide it. There's a member in, so it's incredibly, what I liked about the book and what I've gotten to reading, because I'm all about action. I mean, latch onto it. Of course, I take that and I just think, okay, I'm feeling really sad. I'll go to 3 meetings, make 2 phone calls, 4 prayers, done. It'll be gone, right? And so it doesn't really work that way. And so what I'm beginning to understand and beginning to learn is that it's a process, and whatever my process looks like, it's okay. I am incredibly fearful about feeling sad and really allowing myself to feel the pain because I think I'm not going to come out. But what I at least know at this point in my recovery is that the structure and the framework I have of calling my sponsor, receiving calls from sponsees, being of service, getting to meetings, reading the literature, that allows some structure to my life so I can keep plugging away while this grief process happens. Like, it doesn't have to take me down and paralyze me. But it's difficult still for me to create that space where I can feel whatever I'm going to feel. I mean, the last workshop I was in, we were talking about the traditions, and somebody, and I get the context of the joke. It's that, you know, we work the traditions to protect other people from us, right? So I get that Al-Anons can be really prickly, and I do know that in my experience, it seems like we kind of fall down the line. We're either doormats or bulldozers, and I'm a doormat. I mean, I am a doormat, but what's, and I get the context of the joke, but that's, I can't do that anymore. I mean, the reason why I'm working this program and doing this thing is so that I can feel okay in my skin. And what that means is I deserve to take up some space on this planet. Because when I got here, I felt so incredibly worthless. So I don't use this program to keep people away or to keep you safe. I'm using it to try to get close to you. Because fundamentally deep inside, every single day, and I'm coming up against that thought that there's something wrong, you're broken. And I'm not. There's nothing broken about me because I have experienced this stuff with alcoholism. I married, my first husband was an alcoholic, active alcoholic, he still is. So we knew each other for 2 weeks, and then I asked him to marry me. Okay, I got that one out. Okay. I know. So the loss of that marriage was devastating. The loss of, I was in recovery for, you know, 6 years or something, and then we divorced. And it was the loss of that, you know, it was the loss of that idea that I was going to be able to share this experience with my husband someday, that we'd sit in a meeting, an open meeting of recovery, and we would bring that in our home. And it hasn't been like that. It was, you know, all the losses that go with divorce and the financial loss. And I took it, it hurt every time my kids went over to their dad's. Every time it was heartache. And to just keep moving through that loss, you know, there's some part of me at some point when I was young thinking that there's something wrong if I'm sad. I'm doing it wrong. And to be able to just be comfortable with, you know, I'm human and this is part of the human experience, what I immediately want to do is I want to fight that and say, well, this sucks. God, why are you doing this? You know, why are you doing this to me? And I can't pray to a God that I think is putting pain in my life intentionally to teach me a lesson. That's just me. I can't do it. I can pray to a God that appreciates and understands that I'm moving about in this world and stuff's going to happen and I get hurt and that God's going to help me get through that experience. But as soon as I think that God's setting up hurdles or challenges or obstacles, I mean, I do enough of that crap by myself. I don't need the power of the universe to do it with me, you know? So as soon as I do that stuff, I'm going to shut down and I'm not going to ask God for help. So this whole idea of grief and loss is when I experience that stuff, my knee-jerk reaction is to isolate and to curl inward. You know, I mean, it's like being a little armadillo. I'm not even from Wisconsin, but we have potato bugs. They do the same thing. They're like little mini armadillos. They're about this big. But, you know, you poke them and they curl in on themselves and they have a hard protective shell. So that's what I like to do as well, just retract and pull in. But it takes me a long time. And I don't, you know, and it's not that I expect to come back and being all soft and fresh and lovely, you know. But I don't want to come back so hardened and so suspicious and fearful. And that's what all that loss, I have to process that stuff. What I want to come back to is a place of, it's okay. I screw up. My kids are, they're affected, and my oldest son is struggling too. Bailed out of college twice. He was suicidal, planned to commit suicide. He planned to take his life when he was 19. I don't know why he didn't. He's 23 years old. He's also on the don't drink by smoking pot daily plan. And he lives in our home, and it's tough. You know, it's tough to watch him. It's a mixed bag, you know, because when he's stoned, he's happy. And that's what his dad was like. When his dad was drunk, he was happy. As when he was sober, he was a jag. So it's tough. It's really difficult to watch. It's hard to let go because my heart is breaking. I would love to think that there was something I could do now. I cannot go back to the past and change the decisions that I made. I feel like I didn't protect my son and I should have. But I also can't start hanging on to some false idea that if I would have done it differently, this kid would be doing something else. I do not have that kind of power. So how do I keep myself open to be able to be loving and kind to this kid without letting him trample over me? I am a doormat. It is magnified when it comes to my children. I will pre-doormat myself. Let me just lay out here first. There's no debate. You know, I'll just do it. So it's really challenging. And for whatever reason, my Monday night home group is full of moms. You know, it's full of moms. And it's really, really hard. It's, you know, and to say, it kind of makes me sad. I mean, I feel this too. It wasn't as difficult to end the marriage with my alcoholic first husband as it is to watch this struggle with my kids. And I don't know why. I don't know why, but it's, what other losses can we talk about? Well, I'm middle-aged and, but you know, I just read that chapter in the book and it was talking about the loss of the dream. And there is a lot of stuff along the way where you keep putting the expectation up real high. And I always did it to try to compensate for the disaster I just walked away from. Well, but if this happens, this will make up for that. You know, I'm always trying to make this scale kind of work out and tip in my favor. And it never felt like it did. I mean, it was just one colossally bad decision after another. So, you know, coming up on middle age, I mean, I feel like I don't have enough time left. And that's a difficult thing to admit. Like, I feel like I've screwed too much of it up. I don't have enough left to be able to dream And so that's very humbling, because I know that's a lie and I know it's fear. So what I was really grateful for, and I just thought, I just said that to my husband, and I are in counseling right now, and not for our marriage, but for these 20-somethings. Like, I thought, there wasn't much of a loss feeling when they were in high school and graduated. It was like, yeah. But these 20-somethings are horrible. And so our marriage was really taking a hit. So, and we were in counseling, and I just said that to our counselor. I said, I don't feel like I have enough time. And it's not like I don't feel it. I mean, I am choking on feeling like I have run out of time. I have screwed this all up. What am I going to do? Thank God it was like, okay, I'm going to the AA International. And if I cannot get some hope from 56,000 other people here, come on now. Right? So, and thank you. And I did. I heard it yesterday. I don't know if it was in the big meeting, but I heard somebody say, fear's knocking, but faith answered. And I'm like, thank you. Oh, it gives me goosebumps thinking about it. So I received my answer, my hope here, and I hope you do too. Thank you.
Thank you, Angie. It was nice to hear a little lightness, because the topic sounds a little heavy, but we can always find lightness in these rooms. Okay, our next speaker is Sandy, and she's from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hello, I'm Cindy. I'm from Louisville, Kentucky.
Hi, Cindy.
Grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon. I brought notes because I am a scatterbrain. I'm not going to read to you, but I am going to refer to the notes. I want to thank Sabrina for asking me to participate in this. When I filled out the survey, I really thought I'd be telling y'all where the bathroom was. I am not as funny as Angie, but here I am. Before Al-Anon, I didn't get asked back to a lot of places. And you all have taught me how to dress up and show up, and sometimes I can even act halfway decent. So that's what I'm trying to do today, is to make my Louisville people proud. And thank you, Lori, for giving me a good recommendation. Lori's known me a lot of years, and she knows how bad I can be. All right. I came into Al-Anon November 20th, 1991. My home group is Hikes Point. AFG meets on Thursday night on Low Road at St. Mark's United Methodist Church. We have a newcomers meeting at 7:30. If you all ever come through Louisville, please stop by. You know, I got this invitation, and I was like, yes! And then I thought, oh, crap. But I have experienced a lot of grief in my life, and so that's what you're going to hear about from me. It's not all butterflies and sunshine. I didn't come in here happy. I didn't come in here because I wanted to be here. I came here because I was an attempted murderer. You can't say that in a lot of venues, and people laugh. It is true. All right, I will tell you all, my husband's nickname is Speed Bump. Ex-husband. Did I say husband? Ex-husband. My current husband is a wonderful man, and he may not be perfect, but he's perfect for me, and he's sitting right there. Mo. I, too, was like Angie. I had not read this book when I got the letter. And so I'm a very studious person, so I immediately started writing down and highlighting and numbering. And so I have a lot of quotes, and they're applicable, and I may or may not read them to you. I am the youngest of three children. We were very poor. We lived with my grandparents and my great-grandfather for the first 5 years of my life, six. And I was happy there. I always had somebody to take care of me, you know, to talk to protect me from my brothers. They were 4 and 5 years older than me, and they were just boys, just mean little boys. And I was a snotty, bratty little girl, and, you know, they didn't want to play with me, and I wanted to go everywhere they went and do everything they did. So I tell you that because they have had a large impact on my life. I was told that I was dumb, and that I was a crybaby, and I was just a girl. So that kind of sets a foundation for where I started. So then we leave that comfy, homey place, and we move up on the hill where my parents could have their own house. Now, I left running water inside bathrooms. You know, I had loving arms around me, a lap to crawl into any time I needed. And it was not quite so homey for me up there. I got put in my own bedroom. I'd never had my own bedroom. I'd always slept in my parents' bedroom. And there was these trees outside my windows, and they had this big security light that shined in. And so you got these creepy trees. I was scared to death. So one of the things that my dad always said was, you know, you gotta toughen up here, and you know, I have to go to the bathroom at night. Well, you gotta go way out behind the house. And he gives me this great big green Rayovac flashlight and makes me go out there. Like I said, I'm like six, and so I knew there were monsters outside. I mean, I just knew it. And so I'm creeping out there, and we had this great big spool thing we used for a picnic table, and a possum come around it, and we ran into each other, and I don't know which one of us was in the worst shape, but I didn't go to the bathroom by night by myself for a long time. So that kind of lays down, you know, the fears and how, you know, you just kind of suck it up and deal with it and go on. And so I'm going to fast forward. I've gotten married. I'm 26. I married an alcoholic, of course. He had three children. I was intent on becoming the best stepmother ever. Somebody needed to straighten those kids out. I used to call them the stepkids from hell, but I don't do that anymore because I realize they are deeply affected by this disease. And, man, they need all the prayers they can get because it's just being passed on down the line. So one of my first losses after my childhood that I had no tools to deal with came when I was around 26, 27. My grandmother that I had lived with was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And, man, what a sad disease. I would go see her, and she'd say, "What'd you do with your horse?" And I'm like, "My horse? I don't know, you know." And finally, I got to telling her that I hitched it out underneath a tree, you know, and she'd be happy with that. Because you can't argue with them. You cannot convince them, you know. It's like dealing with alcoholism, an active alcoholic. And so it was really hard to watch my grandmother decline in health when, you know, she had really been nurturing to me. She taught me how to sew. My grandparents took me everywhere. We went fishing. And I cleaned fish when I was just a little bitty feller. And, you know, just things that grandparents teach you that parents don't have time for. They're busy making a living. And so that was my first one. And it talks about that in in our book about anticipating grief. I can't say the way they wrote it, but anyway, you know, I didn't realize that's a real thing. It says living with the fear of what might happen can be emotional static. It occupies our minds and blocks us from moving forward. We may be watching our loved one die a slow death before our eyes. Wow. That's exactly what I was doing. I didn't have this book then. I just had you all. And you all carried me through it and said, you know, it's going to be okay. You're going to be okay. This is going to be okay. And I don't know what I would have done without you all to have walked me through that. My timekeeper over here is with me every step of the way. So that was in 1996, when all my big grief, I call it my big grief year because in May of 97, my grandfather died. And it was like I lost a piece of my heart. You know, it was like a big old black hole with cold air blowing through it. I didn't know what to do with that because, I mean, he was awesome. I still miss him. So that was in May. Then in August, my girlfriend died of cancer. She was like 33, you know, way too young. And so, you know, I'm starting to feel like that these things are not fair. That, you know, God's taking away people that I am not done with yet. In October, my grandmother passed, and I felt relieved. And then I felt guilty that I felt relieved because you're not supposed to feel relieved when somebody that you love dies. You know, that's not right. Well, it is right because she's in a better place. But you all had to tell me that. I didn't get that manual when I got put out in the world. So my grandmother passed. I'm having all these feelings. I'm thinking, you know, I'm afraid to love anybody that they're going to die off. I know that's irrational thinking, but that's where I was. And so my favorite alcoholic uncle died in December. And then I had an aunt die in February. And I'm just overcome with grief. I mean, I'm on my knees. And then in April, my ex-husband and I had a big fight. It was a physical altercation, and we got a divorce. God loves me so much, he won't let me stay where I'm at, ever. But I was on my knees. I was right where God needed me to be to make me teachable. So I'm starting to recognize things that God's doing for me in my life. Like when my grandparents died, my mom wanted to be closer to me. So she bought a house in a neighborhood close to where I lived. And she was taking care of the estate with my grandparents. And so she hadn't moved into the house. But when I walked away from my marriage, I got to go live in her house for a couple of months by myself. God knew I was going to need a place to live. He provided that just like 2 days before I walked out. You know, I can't plan that stuff. I don't have that insight. I started getting real then. I started letting people know that I was sad. That 'cause I'm kind of like an M&M. I'm hard on the outside. I'm kind of soft and mushy on the inside. Not like a tater bug. Anyway, all right, I talked about my mom. I told you I had to refer to these notes because I get lost. I look out and I see all these people and I get lost. But I love this lady in front that's needlepointing because it makes me feel like I'm in my home group. So some of the things that, some of the emotions that I experienced was anger, because, you know, in my home growing up, it was always okay to express anger, but it wasn't okay to cry. You were a crybaby if you cried. And so I was angry. I was a bulldozer, and I just, up until that point, had bulldozed my way through all of the crappy feelings, you know. But I was having problems with God, you know. Even though he was working in my life and giving me a place to live, I really thought God sucked for taking all of my family and friends so quickly together. And you all started telling me that if my God is, you know, if you can love me angry, my God better be able to love me angry, or he's not big enough to handle what's really going on in my life. And that was a big deal for me. That really helped me open up to talking to my God and turning things over to my God and letting him handle what was going on in my life. So with the help of Al-Anon carrying me every step of the way, I got through all of that. I yelled, I screamed, I kicked, I cried, but I got through it. By the way, out there in Sober Store, they have this little stone I bought that says, "Change, here I comes, kicking and screaming." That's me. I don't like it. Okay, during that time is when I really learned to take care of myself. I learned to, you know, take a nap when I'm tired. Because grief is a tiring process. It just sucks the life out of you. And for me, that first year of after you lose someone, or especially someone, that first year you have to get through the anniversaries of the birthdays and the holidays and whatever else you did together. You know, you have to get through all of that before, I call it the year of molasses. You just seem like you're walking through molasses with that grief. And then it kind of, I can emotionally deal with it a little more the second year. And that's just what I have found out about me. So I'm going to fast forward some more. November 10th, 2005, I'm at work. I've just passed my welding test. I'm very excited. And my brother calls and tells me that my dad had passed. My dad's not sick. I mean, I don't know what happened. So where I work and where I used to live is about an hour apart. And when I got there, I found out that my dad committed suicide. It's not what I believe in. It's not a choice that I would have made. I didn't think he would have made that choice until that day. I'm going to read to you now. Because this quote says it, really. It's on page 99. And it's about facing the death or facing a suicide or sudden death. "Receiving the news of suicide can turn our world upside down. After the initial shock, we may blame ourselves for not seeing the warning signs. We may feel somehow responsible, believing we could have done something to prevent it." I'm going to skip a little bit. "Facing a suicide or sudden death carries its own particular weight. We are robbed of the chance to say goodbye to our loved one, to deal with any unfinished business that may have been lingering between us, or to make amends. We may vacillate between blaming the alcoholic and ourselves. We can't help but feel as if our loved one's death could have been avoided. If only we had tried harder, we tell ourselves. Maybe we could have prevented this. If only I had pushed more. If only I hadn't pushed so much. If only the alcoholic wasn't so stubborn. If only. The if onlys are a natural reaction to the news that our loved one is truly gone. It's part of how reality sinks in as our minds cope with our shock. Though we may try to analyze or make sense of our loved one's death, the truth is we may or may not ever fully understand. And that's me. I'm down on my knees again. I'm like, did I miss a sign? Well, of course I miss signs. You look back, you think, you can make stuff up in your head when you look back of signs that you miss, you know. And I did miss signs. You know, the whole family missed signs. But there was no group conscience. Dad didn't call each up and say, hey, what do you think about this? You know, he just did it. I was angry at the world. You all held me up and told me it's okay. One more time, it's okay to be angry at God, and it's okay to be angry and sad. It's okay. It's okay. You're going to be okay. So I yelled and screamed and cried some more and told God again how crappy I thought he was. And he loves me. My God loves me no matter what kind of temper tantrum I throw. He loves me anyway. And he always puts the right people in my life at the very right time, exact right time. You know, when Dad committed suicide, I didn't really know anybody that had experienced suicide. And it is unique because there is a lot of guilt that's, for me, that was attached to it. What could I have done differently? And, you know, God just kept putting people in my life that had that experience. And I got through it. You all helped me up and I got through it. I want to fast forward again to 2008. See, that's why I got these notes. And my mom fell and broke her leg. Oh, I got 5 minutes. Well, I'll make this one really short because I want to tell you what I learned from this experience. I took care of my mom. Mo and I took care of my mom. And I learned how to let go of her some. That was a process. And it was a big change because I became the parent sort of taking care of her. But the big thing that I learned from this assignment is I got displaced out of my job 3 years ago. It was a shock. It was just like the call when my dad committed suicide. My world was rocked. I mean, my job, I worked hard. I was a journeyman. I was a skilled tradesman. And I am getting sent somewhere else, or I can take an indefinite layoff, or I can go to production. And today I know, through a lot of step work, that my pride was involved in that. I'd probably make a different decision if I could go back and do it again, but I was pissed at God one more time. I had to go back to school. I have really been grappling with this. I mean, I don't go to school in a good part of town. And so I've been angry all this time because anger's the one biggie that I can feel that's okay. And I've been reading this book, getting ready for this, and talking to my sponsor, and the big thing that I've learned, because you may think that we're here for you all today, but God's given me the big lesson, is that he really doesn't give a hoot what I do for a living. My job is to carry this message to others. The rest of it just affords me that luxury. And I know that that may not make sense to anybody else, but that is my big lesson out of all of this. And I want to close with a quick little reading. Yep. I told y'all I studied. I'm a good student. It's about keep coming back. Most of us keep coming back to meetings long after the problem that first led us to Al-Anon have been resolved or no longer bother us. Most of us agree that the longer we are in Al-Anon, the more the program can help us in all areas of our lives, not just those related to alcoholism. Al-Anon is not a program of completion or destination. The tools we gain here help us lead healthier lives in our work, in our relationships with family, friends, and in our love relationships. Meetings are available throughout the world. If we know we are going to be out of town, we can find a meeting in that area. And I'm real glad y'all came to this meeting today. Thanks.